I am struck by the wealth of the arts gifts that we have in this church. The music, the visuals. Thank you all. It's really lovely. Will you pray with me? May the words of my mouth and the meditations of all of our hearts hold something of your word this day, God, the word you want to speak, the word that will call us, O God, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. I think you have heard from me already that when I was in my 20s, I left the religion of my childhood, and I didn't go back to church for about 10 years. In my journey back to faith, one of the turning points came through a book called What Really Matters: Searching for Wisdom in America. Now, it turns out that the author of that book is Tony Schwartz, who also ghost wrote Donald Trump's book, The Art of the Deal. But for the book I read, Schwartz spent 4 years traveling around the country investigating the traditions and movements where it looked to him like people had found something important about life: truth, purpose, meaning. And he did this both as a journalist and in his own personal quest for wisdom. Here's how it started for him. One night, he was at a reception with hundreds of guests who were there to celebrate the success of the publication of The Art of the Deal. He said, "I was about to earn more in a few weeks than I had in the whole of my working life. It would give me a financial cushion that few people are ever lucky enough to enjoy. Publishers were eager to sign up whatever book I chose to do next. My marriage of 10 years was strong and stable. My wife had her own challenging career, and our two young daughters, who were 2 and 6, were healthy and mostly happy. I jogged several miles a day, and I played tennis at least twice a week. I had several close friends, and I felt I contributed usefully to my community. Why then wasn't I happier?" So he set out to see if he could find something that might make him deeply, enduringly happy. Some purpose that would make everything else that happened in his life, good or bad, make sense. And over 4 years, Schwartz tried all kinds of things. Things like yoga, meditation, dream therapy, popular Buddhism, the Enneagram. He never tried church, which was curious to me at the time, but maybe it's not surprising in American culture today. But here's what he said as he got to the end of his 4 years. He said, "An unmistakable pattern emerged. I'd be introduced to an impressive teacher, a new system, a novel set of insights, or an interesting technique for tapping the depths of unconsciousness. And I quickly became enraptured and immersed. Often enough that it amused my friends and colleagues, I'd announce that I finally had the answer, or at least the best way to go about seeking it. In time, however, my initial passion gave way to the skepticism that always lurked just beneath the surface. A particular technique, so powerful at first, inevitably began to provide diminishing returns. I would become increasingly aware of the disparity between the teacher's inspiring message and his everyday behavior. spiritually, by the end of the book, he found nothing. Nothing that satisfied his longing for truth or that seemed powerful enough to carry him. He never lost himself in a new way of being. He said, "I was seeking a form of wisdom that was suited to my own life and to the culture that I lived in. I wasn't interested in renouncing my material desires or giving up my professional ambitions." In other words, he set out to find truth, but only a truth that wouldn't seriously change the contours of his life. And he never found anything that was life-changing enough, compelling enough, to push him past those limits that he had set at the beginning. Each time that he got close to giving himself totally away, when he got that feeling of being drawn toward a new truth, a purpose that might answer his search for meaning, he'd hold it up to the light. How it looked when someone tried unsuccessfully to practice it, what kinds of changes it might require in his own life. And every time he measured it against those practicalities, the glow would fade until he could walk away easily. In a book I was reading more recently, another author called those moments when we feel drawn to give ourselves over to a bigger purpose, he called them an epiphany of recruitment. A moment when something new opens up and draws you beyond yourself. A moment when you're inspired by compassion or love to give yourself away for something good. Something that might be a calling to you. This author remembered a Sunday at his Catholic church when he was a child. He was carrying in his pocket all the dimes that he had been saving from his allowance. And that morning there was a speaker in church from the St. Vincent de Paul Society. And she talked about the society's work with people who were very, very poor. And this little boy felt inspired. So spontaneously, he took all the money out of his pockets and he put it into the offering plate. After church, to his great surprise, his father thought that he had made a terrible mistake. And to make his point even more clear, this father punished the boy by not giving him any allowance for the next 2 weeks. What stung that little boy even more than the punishment, he said, was something his father said to him that day. "Nobody likes a holy Joe." Now, we might think that father made a terrible mistake with his son. But I would bet that most of us have some version of that father's voice in our own heads. It's the voice that responds to our own epiphanies of recruitment by saying, "Be practical. Don't get carried away. You're not a hero." Mostly, we respond to even our most vivid epiphanies by rationalizing them away. I promise you, it's not just you. It's all of us. It is part of our human nature to second-guess the voice that seems only spiritual, less real. The great philosopher William James acknowledged that if he told the truth about himself, he really wanted to be both a saint and a millionaire. ...70% of the students entering Harvard Law School say they plan to practice public interest law. Only about 3% actually do it. The opportunities to take a path that will bring more money or prestige or comfort are just too compelling. The question for each of us is, which voice will we listen to? The story Eric read this morning from 1 Samuel is a reminder of how deeply and essentially human this internal dialogue is. Samuel will become one of the most important prophets in Jewish history. But in this story, he is just a boy. He's in the care of the old wise priest Eli, so that he too might learn what it means to give his whole life to God. Now, Samuel was an attentive pupil. And on this night, he is sleeping in the very center of the worship space. Nate, can you grab that slide? Thanks. Next slide. So he's sleeping in the center of the worship space, the room where the Ark of God was kept, the container that held the law itself. This was the most holy space possible, because the Ark was, for the ancient Israelites, like the very physical presence of God among them. But even here, in this holy space, the voice of God is not all that clear. 3 times Samuel heard a voice calling his name, and it's not until the 3rd time that he figures out that it's God. After he has gone 2x to Eli and asked, "What can I do for you?" Finally, Eli says, "I'm telling you, it wasn't me. Maybe there's something going on here that you should pay attention to." Indeed, there was. God was trying to speak. And when Samuel is paying enough attention to hear, God says, "I just want to tell you, I am about to do something big. Something so big that it will make your ears tingle when you hear it." Once in a while, God lets his sense of humor show. But here's the line in this story that really catches my attention. It's early in the story, even before God begins to call Samuel. The passage says, "The word of the Lord was rare in those days. Visions were not widespread." And I wonder, was the word of the Lord rare because God had stopped speaking? Where had all the visions gone? Maybe God had been speaking all along. Maybe there were epiphanies of recruitment everywhere, only the people hadn't recognized God's voice. Or they let other voices in their heads talk them out of responding. Because responding to God's voice can seem impractical, ill-considered, maybe even dangerous. Have you seen the movie Dead Poets Society? It's several years old now, but I love this movie. And in it, Robin Williams is an English teacher at a very traditional boys' school. He uses poetry to inspire in the boys a different, freer way of looking at the world than anything they have ever seen before. But he's too edgy for the school's administration, a little bit dangerous to its traditions, the status quo. This is the scene just after he is fired. Watch the internal dialogue that gets played out in these boys. Can we start that again? We got the sound?
What is poetry?
That page has been ripped out, sir.
Well, borrow somebody else's book.
They're all ripped out, sir.
What do you mean they're all ripped out?
Sir, we...
Never mind. Read.
We got nothing.
Are we going to get it or not?
No, you're not going to get it unless you know how to run the computer.
Sorry. Thanks for your patience. That was a good sign.
What is poetry?
That page has been ripped out, sir.
Well, borrow somebody else's book.
They're all ripped out, sir.
What do you mean they're all ripped out?
Sir, we...
Never mind. Read.
Understanding Poetry by Dr. J. Evans Pritchard, Ph.D. To fully understand poetry, we must first be fluent with its meter, rhyme, and figures of speech. Then ask two questions. One, how artfully has the objective of the poem been rendered? And two, how important is that objective? Question one rates the poem's perfection. Question two rates its importance. And once these questions have been answered, determining the poem's greatness becomes a relatively simple matter. If the poem score for perfection is plotted on the horizontal of a graph...
Mr. Keating, they made everybody
sign... Mr. Anderson?
You gotta believe me, it's true.
I do believe you, Tom.
Leave, Mr. Keating.
But it wasn't his fault.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson. One more outburst from you or anyone else, and you're out of this school. Leave, Mr. Keating. I said leave, Mr. Keating.
Captain, my captain.
Sit down, Mr. Anderson. Do you hear me? Sit down. Sit down! This is your final warning, Anderson. How dare you? Do you hear me?
Oh, Captain, my captain.
Mr. Overstreet, I warned you. Sit down. Sit down, all of you. I want you seated. Sit down. Leave, Mr. Keating.
That struggle you could see on those boys' faces, that's what's supposed to be happening inside of people who are trying to follow Jesus. Church should be the Eli in your life, the voice that says to you, I think that might be God talking to you. The voice you hear here will, I hope, move you toward your own epiphanies of recruitment, and then beyond them, to take the dangerous step of giving yourself away for the sake of compassion and justice. Even when other voices are saying, that seems excessive or unbalanced. If you don't want the contours of your life to change, I'm not sure this is the right place for you. Church is a place for people who are ready to have their lives disrupted. You get to decide whether to make your place here, to belong in a community that will not leave you alone, a community that is listening for the God who repairs the world by calling out to people like us with new words and new visions, ones that just might make your ears tingle. Amen.